Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Good morning, colleagues. Welcome to the first day of committee. Really excited to have an excellent committee here, and I thought we'd start out today, given that we have a number of new faces, by just going down the dais and doing some introductions. So we'll start at this end. Representative Jessica Vega Peterson.
Hello, yes, thank you. I'm Representative Jessica Vega Peterson from House District 47, which is in East Portland.
Representative Cliff Benz from House District 60, which is the five Oregon counties furthest east.
Okay. Introduce yourself.
My name's Adam Crawford. I'm going to be the committee administrator today.
Liz Bailey from Inner East Side Portland.
Mark Johnson from House District 52. I live in Hood River and represent District 52, which is all of Hood River County, some of Clackamas, and a little smidgen of Multnomah as well.
I'm Michael Dembro. I'm House District 45. That's Northeast Portland out to Park Rose, including Oregon's only city inside of a city. That's the wonderful city of Maywood Park.
Gail Whitsitt.
Is there a mayor in Maywood Park?
Okay. District 56, which is Klamath and Lake County, from Highway 140 south to the California border.
And I'm Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48, outer southeast Portland, northern Clackamas County. And I'm just delighted to be here working with the rest of you.
Great. And with our other colleagues who will be joining us shortly, I think we have a nice swath of the state represented on this committee. So we'll look forward to some interesting debates from a lot of different perspectives on a wide array of issues. I would be remiss if I didn't start the first committee hearing, though, by I wanted to say a special thanks. We're in a new session now, but I want to say a special thanks to a member who is no longer on this committee, to my former co-chair, Representative Vic Gilliam, who I enjoyed serving with on this committee. I thought did a really magnificent job and really got the debate in this committee to a point where I think we're going to be able to have some really focused discussions here. And if I was a funnier person, I'd probably make a Vic Gilliam joke at this point in his honor. But alas, Mark, that will now fall to you for all of your comments. So good luck with that.
A cameo role for Vic.
Yeah, exactly. Let him pop in. No, we won't. Okay, we have a relatively full agenda today. Today we're going to have the first of what I hope will be, in addition to the bills that we're hearing, a number of informational hearings so that folks on the committee have an opportunity to get up to speed on some of the energy and environmental issues that are facing the state, so we have a common, at least, frame of reference for some of the discussions that we'll be having. But before we get to that fun stuff, we have a raft of committee measures for potential introduction. And colleagues, I would remind you that I view committee bill introduction as a courtesy to all the members on this committee. So if you have additional, this will not be your only opportunity. If there are other additional legislative LC drafts that you want to introduce, please get them to us by the bill introduction deadline. Be happy to get those into the process. So I would also remind the committee and those listening that a vote in favor or against a bill introduction does not indicate in any way support for or opposition to the measure. It is purely a formality to get it into the process. So with that, we have a ton. I'd entertain a motion.
Chair Bailey, I move to adopt the proposed... those are rules. We're not on there.
Do you have this for him on... Yes, right here. You're holding it.
Next side of that?
Right there.
Oh, up there on top. Perfect. Chair Bailey, I move to adopt the following LCs.
Rookie mistake.
Yeah.
I forgot to open the work session.
There you go.
I will now open a work session on introduction of committee measures. I'll take a message.
Chair Bailey, I move that we adopt the following LCs, and I would mind also add that it'd be nice to see how many members are still conscious when we get to the end of this list.
Okay, we'll be.
Ready? LC 847, LC 936, LC 944, LC 997, LC 1009, LC 1011, LC 1012, LC 1013, LC 1014, LC 1381, LC 1930, LC 1966, LC 2037, LC 2189, LC-2194, LC-2195, LC-2197, LC-2200, LC-2236, LC-2242, LC-2256, LC-2264, LC-2385, LC-2480, LC-2484, LC-2772, LC-3200, LC-3376, LC-3485. May I have a throat lozenge, please?
That's it. Great. Vice Chair Johnson moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC-847, LC-936, LC-944, LC-997, LC-1009, LC-1011, LC-1012, LC-1013, LC-1014, LC-1318, LC-1930, LC-1966, LC-2037, LC-2189, LC-2194, LC-2195, LC-2197, LC-2200, LC-2236, LC-2242, LC-2256, LC-2264, LC-2385, LC-2480, LC-2484, LC-2772, LC-3200, LC-3376, and LC-3485. Is there any discussion?
You're going to scare Obi.
No, I know. He's shaking.
He's going to think you're after his job.
Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Committee's measures are introduced. Okay, I will close the work session on committee bill introduction, and we will move to our organizational meeting. Adam, do I need to open a work session for the committee rules?
Yes, I believe so.
Open a work session on committee rules. Adam, you want to explain to us the committee rules we have before us?
Sure. The committee rules are very similar to what you'll see in previous and other committees. They're modeled after the chamber rules. They are identical in each committee for the consistency from one committee to the next. While they are not perfectly identical to previous short session committee rules, which were modified to account for the shortness of the session, they are identical to previous long session committee rules, with the exception of the following. Any references to dual leadership or co-governance have been removed. Item 16B has been slightly refined. Refining is the words "of said measure" have been added to require the ideas in a minority report to be raised during discussion of the underlying subject or measure. Item 17 is entirely new with regard to declaration of conflict in committee. First, it requires committee to announce committee members to announce conflicts prior to voting in committee, the same way they do on the floor of the chamber. Second, it requires a written statement of conflict to be provided to the committee assistant by 5 p.m. of the next business day after the committee votes.
Thank you. Colleagues, I'd point you to number 17. I'm sure you have seen it in other committees, but it is a major change from the way that committees have done business in the past, so I just point that out to you again. Is there any discussion from the committee on the rules?
Okay. Chair Bailey, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 5, 2013.
Representative Johnson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 5th, 2013. Any further discussion? Any objection? All right, the rules are adopted. We'll close the work session on rules, committee rules. Moving right along. For our first of our informational hearings, we thought we would begin by having some of the key players in the energy arena introduce themselves to you so they become familiar faces, as I'm sure you'll see them in front of this committee and in your offices regularly. And we'd like to invite up Lisa Schwartz, Director of the Department of Energy, and Margie Hoffman. Oh, yeah. We'll open the informational hearing. Great. Ms. Schwartz.
Chairman Bailey, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Schwartz. I'm the new director of the Oregon Department of Energy. Thank you for having me here today. Although I'm new as director of the agency, I'm not new to the department. I worked there from 1995 to 2002. I then worked at the Public Utility Commission for 7 years. And most recently, the last 4 years, I worked for an organization that provided assistance on energy issues in the U.S. and abroad. I'm happy to be back in state government. I have reset in the 2 months I have been with the agency, the agency's mission. We focus on reducing the long-term cost of energy for all Oregonians. My main areas of focus are cost-effective energy efficiency, efficient siting processes for major energy facilities, and continuing to improve how the state deploys its incentives, grants, and loans for energy projects. I'm focused on rebuilding our relationships with stakeholders, attracting new talent to the department, and providing excellent customer service. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce myself, and I really look forward to working with all of you.
Margie? Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I'm Governor Kitzhaber's energy policy advisor, and I'm very excited to be sitting here next to our new director of the department, Lisa Schwartz. I have been working in this capacity since April of 2012, but I've been working on energy policy issues in the state for a number of years with a lot of stakeholders in this room and a lot of elected officials in this room. For the last year and change, I have been in the process of drafting the governor's 10-year energy action plan, the final energy action plan. It's on the Department of Energy's website. It was released in December of last year, and so we look forward to working with all of you as we move forward to implement that 10-year energy action plan and the legislative components thereof. And thank you for the opportunity to come say hi.
Great. Thank you. We'll have ample opportunity, colleagues, I'm sure, to discuss many issues with these two fine folks as we go throughout session. Any initial introductory questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your time. And continuing on, we are going to move on to, as part of this informational meeting, a report back from the Public Utility Commission on energy efficiency power purchase agreements that was requested in Section 6 of House Bill 2960 from the 2011 legislative session. So I'd like to call forward Eisdorfer, and Juliet Johnson.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, Vice Chairs Boone and Johnson, members of the committee. I am Jason Eisdorfer, the Director of the Utility Program at the Public Utility Commission. With me is Julia Johnson, Senior Utility Analyst on my staff. 2 months ago, December 1, 2012, the Public Utility Commission forwarded to the legislature a report on energy efficiency purchase power agreements, and we were invited here to talk to you for a couple of minutes to describe what an EEPPA is and to talk a little bit about the highlights of that report. And before I turn it over to the person who herded all the cats and drafted the report, I have a couple of minutes of context. The Public Utility Commission, as you know, regulates the investor-owned utilities in the state, telecom, water, electricity, and natural gas, and most relevant, the last two in terms of the EEPPA. Core to that regulation is the PUC oversight over the electricity utilities' choice of resources to serve Oregon customers in the least cost, least risk manner. And when we're talking about those resources on the electricity side, we're talking about generating resources, coal, natural gas, wind, solar, biomass, geothermal. But I think that the preferred resource is cost-effective energy efficiency. Cost-effective energy efficiency is, by definition, less expensive than the next highest cost generating resource, and it has a lower footprint when at the end of the day. In Oregon, the two electric utilities and two natural gas utilities use the Energy Trust of Oregon as the energy efficiency delivery mechanism. The Public Utility Commission has several layers of oversight over the Energy Trust. The Energy Trust has energy efficiency programs for residential, commercial, and industrial customers. In my mind, it is one of the best, if not the best, delivery mechanism for utility energy efficiency in the country. But I think one of the themes of energy efficiency over the last 20 and 30 years is always trying to find that delivery mechanism, that silver bullet that gets you as much of the cost-effective energy efficiencies you can at the lowest price. And so that sort of brings us to the EEPPA. There have been some thinking recently about how can we go deeper, how can we go deeper into the building, the commercial building, the home, to get the harder, the more expensive energy efficiency, still cost effective, and do it in a way that is sustained over a long period of time. And so the EEPPA is one of those mechanisms that people have been thinking about. Let me make one last point before I turn it over to Juliet, and that is that even though energy cost effective energy efficiency is the lowest cost and arguably the lowest risk resource, it's hard. You have to get into thousands of people's homes and businesses and industrial processes. And I think another theme in energy efficiency is there probably is no silver bullet. You're going to have a bunch of different priorities of consumers, different appetites for risk, different priorities. So clearly, I think one of the themes of the PUC report here when looking at the EEPPA is where is it appropriate? Where does it work? What sectors does it work with? And where may it not be appropriate? So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Juliet, who will describe the EEPPA for you and the report.
Thank you, Jason. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Juliet Johnson with the Oregon Public Utility Commission staff, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk to you about the Energy Efficiency Power Purchase Agreements. So, House Bill 2960 in 2011 directed the Public Utility Commission to develop a report on Energy Efficiency Power Purchase Agreements, or EEPPAs, as we call them for short. The PUC submitted this report to the legislature back in December of 2012. In preparing the report, we really tried to tap into the wisdom and knowledge of as many regional and national experts as we could. We had a day-long workshop with some experts from around the country. We also sent out extensive surveys, and we provided two draft versions of the report to stakeholders so they could comment on them. So just briefly touching on this, as Jason was saying, energy efficiency is currently the cheapest energy resource. And basically what that means to me is that it's cheaper to save energy than it is to buy or build new power plants or to buy energy in the market. So energy efficiency basically costs about 3 cents per kilowatt hour, compared to generating or buying new energy costs about 6 to 9 cents. So we're talking 2 to 3 times cheaper than generating or buying new energy. And as Jason was describing, the Energy Trust runs the energy efficiency programs for the large investor-owned utilities around the state. But for those Oregonians who are not served by PacifiCorp, PGE, Northwest Natural, or Cascade Natural Gas, in those cases, usually the utility company would be the entity that would be running the energy efficiency programs. So the Energy Trust or the utility, what essentially they go out and they buy the energy efficiency by paying incentives and by providing services to customers. And traditionally the way this is done is right up front when a customer is buying something or beginning a project, a lump payment is provided in essence to buy that energy efficiency. And then there's third party comes around and spot checks later to make sure that that saving was actually realized. So that's kind of business as usual. You've got a single upfront payment for the savings. Moving on to the Energy Efficiency Power Purchase Agreement, the term PPA or Power Purchase Agreement traditionally is used to describe a agreement or contract to buy and sell power from a generating resource like a solar plant or a gas plant. The difference between an EEPPA and the way that that's different than a traditional PPA is that it's an agreement to buy and sell energy efficiency over time. The key features of an EEPPA is that it's a contract between two or more parties. The payments are made over time instead of all up front, which is what we see now with most programs. And another key thing is that savings must be measured and validated over time, because if payments are going over time, you need to make sure over time that you are getting the savings that you're paying for. Okay, so here's a diagram, a very simple diagram of how we have things now. The Energy Trust or the utility basically provides an upfront one-time incentive to a project owner, or building owner in this case, and then the energy savings that are provided back to the utility or the energy trust, and that way the utility doesn't need to buy new power on the market or build power plants. And so this model works actually quite well for many sectors, and it's quite simple. Moving on to the Energy Efficiency Power Purchase Agreement, we have a new third-party provider in the mix here. And that entity works with the building owner and designs and installs energy efficiency measures and then also verifies to make sure those savings are happening. So in essence, the building owner is providing the savings to the third party, who then has a contract with the utility to provide the savings to the utility. The utility pays for those savings from the third party. So where we see the circle, that's in essence the power purchase agreement. There's an agreement between the utility and the third party to buy and sell energy savings over time. And in summary here, the utility then, again, what they're getting is they're getting savings, so they don't need to buy power on the market or build new power plants. What the building owner is getting is a upgraded building, which often they can charge more rent for. They can have higher occupancy rates. And that third-party provider kind of facilitates the whole process and also may help secure financing for the project. So this is a quick summary of what an EEPPA might look like. There's a lot of different variations of the model, but this is kind of just a general idea of what we're talking about. So has this been tried before? The answer is yes. In the mid-90s and early 2000s, a number of U.S. electric utilities tried these types of programs, and the results were that they basically worked mostly for large commercial buildings or industrial customers. But they found there were a number of challenges associated with complex contracts, and this need to continue to monitor these savings over time is quite expensive, and after a while, people kind of tired of doing that, and there was also some disputes about whether really the savings they thought there were. So virtually all those programs ended or evolved into programs more like what the Energy Trust is offering now, where the payment's made upfront one time. So this is the past history with these types of programs. So the question is, why are we looking at this again? Well, the Energy Trust and utilities are, in places where there's no Energy Trust service, have been pretty good at getting savings, like Jason was saying, from the residential market, the industrial, and a certain commercial customers. But there still is a hard nut to crack when it comes to these large commercial office buildings. That's been more of a challenge to get energy efficiency, and part of that is because the landlord-tenant relationship, the landlord is the one who would buy and put the energy efficiency measures in, where the tenant would be the one who would benefit from lower bills. So that's part of the reason that this is still an opportunity. So there's a renewed interest in finding ways to get savings in large commercial office buildings. And another reason we're looking at this again is new wireless technology and computer models may make it more cost-effective and cheaper and easier to kind of monitor and pay for these savings over time. So it could be a little bit different than it was 20 years ago. Okay, so what did we find out in the report? Where an energy efficiency power purchase agreement may be most feasible are, first of all, it needs to be a stable, long-term use of the building or building ownership. Because if the building use is changing, it makes verifying savings and really figuring out the savings very difficult. It works best for large buildings and large projects, what we might refer to as deep energy retrofits. And the owners must be willing to enter into these kind of contracts. It's not optimal for residential customers, small commercial, or equipment such as incenting people to buy high-efficiency appliances or computers. Now, the reason these first three aren't optimal is they're small, and when you get an EEPPA, there's a lot of contracts, and so it's not really cost-effective to do something so big for relatively small savings. It's also not good if you don't have extremes in peaks weather or peak loads, because if you're not having a lot of high loads and extreme weather events, you're just not going to quite save as much to maybe make it worthwhile. And also in regions where power prices are low, again, you're not going to get as much savings. And then where you don't have a big inventory of commercial buildings, it may not be optimal either, because if you have a lot of buildings, you can kind of spread the administration costs over a number of buildings, and also it just becomes a little bit more cost effective that way. Another key finding is where will EE PPAs maybe have advantages over other models? The key thing here is where persistence is an issue. And persistence is defined as maintaining energy savings over a long time. There's a number of energy efficiency measures that have no problems with persistence. Things like insulation, they're going to operate, there's going to be no degradation of savings over time. Also lights, they're pretty good. But where you have manual controls, where someone can go in and change a thermostat, or the kind of more sophisticated operational and human dependent types of measures, you might see degradations of savings over time. So in those cases, having an EEPPA in place where you're monitoring and not over time, you might actually see some increased savings, which would be better for the utilities and ratepayers. So that's a place where the EEPPA may be a good fit. And then another place is where the existence of that contract between the utility and the third party, it may enable lower cost financing, or maybe it'll even help someone get financing who wouldn't otherwise have been able to. So we found that may be another good place for an EEPPA. Let's see, potential disadvantages is it is costly to do this ongoing monitoring verification. So that's a potential disadvantage. There are unknown cost and risks. And one of the risks is the next bullet here, which is there may be changes in ownership or use of the building. And there could be some disputes and there could be some uncertainty and risks associated with that. And then lastly here, utilities and customers just may not want to participate in this because it can be complex and different than what they're used to. Okay, let's see. Well, last slide here. Maybe you see it in your handout. Okay, well, this worked well enough. Okay, so final thoughts. New computer modeling and new measuring tools may make these more effective than they were when they were tried 15, 20 years ago. So they may reduce the challenges of EEPPAs. Basically, we think it's important that utilities and ratepayers not pay more for energy efficiency than they really need to. So we need to make sure that the ratepayers and the utilities are still benefiting from whatever is tried. And we should not pay more than the next cheapest resource. So if there's something else that's cheaper to do than energy efficiency projects, we should really look closely at that. Lastly, Commission staff is currently working with the Energy Trust and other stakeholders on moving forward with an appropriate pilot to look at these types of deep energy savings in large commercial buildings, and looking at how we can maintain persistence type of savings. But also in the last bullet here, the PUC is committed to providing reliable energy at the lowest cost and lowest risk. So anything we look at with regards to a pilot, we'll kind of use those things as the main metric by which we'll kind of gauge the how we want to move forward with the pilot. So Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today, and be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you for the work that you put in to this report, as a number of people on this dais worked on House Bill 2960, and I can say that I think I can speak for everybody when I say that I'm very impressed with the level of effort that the PUC put into crafting this report. So I think it's a very useful roadmap. Colleagues, I would, just for your information, to my knowledge, there is no legislation or bill this session around this concept, but it is a report that we asked for from the PUC, and I think in their investigation of that report highlights some interesting issues within the area of energy efficiency, which we will discuss extensively, and some of the challenges there. So with that frame, any questions from the committee?
Chair, if there are no legislation planned around this, what are logical next steps? Because it seems like this is one of the issues that when I went to the Energy Trust, I interviewed them this summer, they talked about, you know, how do we get more energy efficiency out of the large commercial buildings. This looks like a really smart approach. So what's the next step?
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon, the next step that we're taking is having discussions with the Energy Trust and with stakeholders to design a pilot to test not just one but several potential buildings and see how this works. I think the next speakers that you have coming up, if I have my order right, are some of the stakeholders that we've been talking to, and they will actually come and describe some of their thinking. They will have a say in what that pilot looks like.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Dimber.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So are there examples of projects like this that have been done in Oregon or in other states?
Chair Bailey, Representative Dembro, not that I know of, not in Oregon currently. There's some, the Energy Trust is working on some deep retrofit types of projects, but they don't have the same kind of long-term pay-for-performance over time quality. So this would be the first in Oregon, at least in a long time.
And in other states?
Well, you'll hear about some pilots that are going on in Washington. The next speakers will talk about that.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
Chair, I was wondering, could you describe what parameters or factors you use to determine the 3 cents per kilowatt hour cost that you, it was like on page 3?
Sure.
Yeah, 3 versus 6.
Yeah, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, that is the amount of, so the Energy Trust pays for savings that they acquire. They have their own kind of, it's their overhead, their administrative costs. It's also the costs of the incentives that are provided to people to incent them to use energy, to do energy efficiency measures. And it also includes going back after the fact to kind of spot check to see that indeed the savings were materializing. So those are the actual costs that and in that 3 cents that the Energy Trust incurs to go out and obtain those energy savings. Does that answer your question?
Thought?
Yes. I was wondering, when you mentioned incentives, could you describe what incentives mean?
Sure, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt. For instance, if there's a, the trust will go out to an industrial facility and they'll look around and they'll see a bunch of pumps and air compressors that could be traded out for a much more efficient model, and they would save X number of kilowatt hours per hour or per year that they were operating. And so in order to incent the big industrial customer to go ahead and make this change out, they'll say, we will actually pay you, we'll give you a check for some money for you to go ahead and make this change out. So they're providing cash incentives to industrial customers, also to residential customers, to incent them to buy the most energy efficient technology, and that accumulates the savings then from those purchases. Those are the incentives.
Okay. And I apologize, committee, I put the cart a little bit before the horse here, in that we're having this this briefing today because their presentation was ready and they'd prepared the report. However, I believe a week from today, we will be having a much more extensive presentation from these same folks from the Energy Trust and from some of the utilities that will go through some of those items in detail about how all of that functions. Any other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a very interesting report, and I sadly haven't had a chance to study it enough, but I guess we'll get another chance. But the lower the cost of energy, the less value of the program. Is that a correct statement? Because I noticed one of the things up there said if we had regions where power prices are low, erodes the, shall we say, efficiency of the program. So my question would be, at what point would we just stop this whole exercise and say, well, it was a good idea, but, in other words, how low do energy prices have to fall before we don't need to do this anymore?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, pretty low. So the avoided cost is going to move around, and it is always going to move around. But there's a supply curve of energy efficiency from very, very cheap and you know, progressively more expensive. And so as energy prices in the market come down, you cut off the higher end of the energy efficiency measures, but you probably never cut off the low end, the cheaper end. So it's not a matter of doing away with energy efficiency as a whole. You just come down the cost curve a little bit, if that makes sense.
Well, your point is that if we had free energy, I'm trying to get to this point. If we had free energy, would there be any need to be efficient? If there was simply no cost?
Theoretically, I suppose that's true.
And but there is a cost, environmental normally. Is that factored into what you've done here, or are you just talking about dollars?
Representative Benz, there are that's a debate that's ongoing about the cost effectiveness test. To what extent is our environmental externalities included in the value of energy efficiency? That's sort of an ongoing conversation that we're having right now.
Mr. Chair, we could go on quite a while, so we'll stop there. Thank you.
Representative Whiter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, when you come back, you don't have to answer this now, but when you come back with your detailed report, I would like to know just a breakdown of the cost of different energy systems that are out there, what it is the cost for solar, what it is for wind power, what it is for hydro, what the cost is for coal-powered plants, gas-powered plants. So that way we know the price per kilowatt hour, and it'd give this group an idea of which direction we should be going, and then maybe the emissions that comes out of each one as well, because there might be members who are interested in that. But in my district, power cost, they're not interested in efficiency, they're interested in power cost, because they can't afford to make their houses more efficient. They can't afford their $300 and $400 a month electric bill, and would like to see their electric bill at about $100 a month. So I would like to see us be focusing on that and taking care of the consumers that are out there and find the cheapest way to do it.
Thank you. Okay, I actually have a couple of questions before you go. One, to what extent does your report, as you look at the cost effectiveness of an EEPPA, to what extent is that based off of cost effectiveness measures that are an aggregate of individual cost effectiveness of individual measures, or are they looking at a whole building cost effectiveness test? And if you were looking at a whole building measure, would that change the calculus at all with regards to like a large scale commercial retrofit?
Let's see, Chair Bailey, I want to make sure I understand your question. So you're saying that the kind of the costs that we're talking about in the report, are they looking at a measure by measure numbers or the whole building?
I guess the question is, in the incentive model, incentives are provided up front generally on a measure by measure basis, right? And so as we're evaluating the cost effectiveness of an EEPPA versus those individual measures, are we accounting for the fact that in the EEPPA you're looking at a systemic view of the building that would be a blend of lots of different measures where you might have high ROI measures offsetting low ROI measures in a whole building context? Is that factored into the report, or is it based off of an aggregation of the individual measure basis?
Chair Bailey, I think it'd be something that would be looked at on a when a project came down the pike to us. I don't think in this report we got into that level of detail, but I think currently the way we gauge cost effectiveness is on a measure by measure basis. We want to make sure that every measure is cost effective and not really looking at it in aggregate so much. But I think unless it's a kind of a pilot project, or if it's has some certain characteristics that could transform the market to make a lot more things cost effective down the road. But I think that's something that could be continued to look at going forward, is because we have really had the policy that that each individual measure needs to be cost effective. And as Jason described, there's some questions about how cost effectiveness is applied. And so I think it could be something as part of this pilot or as future work coming forward that we could take a more holistic whole building approach. But as of now, we really haven't done that. We've really looked and made sure that every single measure that's installed is cost effective.
Great. And one more question. I would imagine that part of the challenge, especially in a large office tower context, is with the human side of energy efficiency. It doesn't matter what kind of light bulbs, it matters what kind of light bulbs you're putting in, but it matters less what kind of light bulbs you're putting in if people are leaving them on 24 hours a day and not turning them off when they leave the room. To the extent that that the EEPPA concept improves the persistence, as you say, is this a tool by which we might get at some of the behavior at the human side of the equation to ensure that the assets that we're installing are performing at their optimum value? And does that lend any additional value above the individual measure ROI?
Chair Bailey, I think that the EEPPA would address more of those kind of human factors, but there's also other models to address those types of human factors. I know the Energy Trust has its own program right now where they're looking at behavioral energy efficiency measures. They've had a lot of success with what they call the Strategic Energy Management Program in industrial facilities, where they train people and kind of change the culture to be a little bit more energy efficiency minded, and they're moving that into other areas now, commercial buildings. And so I think, indeed, the EEPPA, because of the persistence over time, probably would address that quite well, but I think there might be other ways to get at those behavioral things too. That's kind of the leading edge of thinking now, but I agree that the EEPPA would be one probably good way of addressing that as well.
Great. Thank you both. Mr. Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just more of a comment than a question, but I'm glad to see the focus on actual economic efficiencies. One of my personal frustrations or pet peeves, if you will, regarding LEED and the language that defines what LEED actually is and has becomes, seems to me that it is taking a turn more towards, as we've focused on energy efficiency, now we're more focusing more on behavior modification, which obviously can be open for interpretation, whether it's needful, beneficial, and all that kind of stuff. And I'm confident we'll probably get into that over the course of our work this session as well. But I'm happy to see that at least in this study that we're focusing on economic numbers and not the other. So yeah, we'll look forward to hearing more from you as time goes on over that, I'm sure.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thanks.
And with that, colleagues, we are going to turn to some folks who I think can answer some of the questions that Representative Dembo is getting at. I'd like to invite up Stan Price and Tom Konecki. We'll talk with us a little bit about some of their experience with these kinds of models and its potential. And whoever would like to go first can go first.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Stan Price. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Energy Efficiency Council. We're a nonprofit industry association that represents companies that provide efficiency products and services. And I'm joined today by one of my member companies, and Tom Konecki is a unit business manager of the McKinstry Company here in Portland. And I will try not to use up too much of your time so that I can turn it over to Tom in a second and have him talk a little bit about some of his company's experience. I wanted to just spend a few minutes talking to you about a concept that our industry has been thinking about, which we call pay for performance, which is, I think, very closely linked to the concepts that Jason and Juliet were just talking about in the Energy Efficiency Power Purchase Agreement. So I would consider it a type of approach that would be consistent with the kinds of programs that that those folks just presented to you today. So I'll just give you a quick thumbnail, if I can. Like all things in life, I think industry looks at challenges and opportunities within the marketplace in relationship to thinking about energy efficiency opportunities. We certainly agree with folks from the Public Utility Commission that we think that there are more significant opportunities for good energy efficiency savings in not only in office buildings, but we think in a whole host of different mid to large size commercial and institutional properties. So we think there are opportunities for this in university buildings, hospitals, hospitality, quite a number of market verticals. We're thinking about a potentially different approach from the traditional one that Oregon has become so accomplished in through the Energy Trust and utility programs in the state over the last 20 years. We think that pay for performance is an opportunity to approach the market in a different way in relationship to thinking about the risk of making these kinds of investments and the realization of savings. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in a couple of slides in just a second. But fundamentally, and I think this, Chair Bailey, this gets to your earlier comment, this is an opportunity to bring together the nexus of technology and behavior. We can put in more energy efficient materials in our buildings. The energy using systems within a building, whether it's a lighting system, a control system, an HVAC system, but how that particular piece of technology is operated and maintained over time is really the realization of the potential of that technology. So the nameplate efficiency is important, but how that particular piece of equipment is operated over time really dictates the realization of those savings at the meter over the lifetime of the equipment. And so that's really the holy grail. That's what we want, because at the end of the day, we want the customer to appreciate those bill savings by having that meter turn less slowly, because they're actually bringing together both technology and the operation of that technology over time. And we think that this particular approach has the opportunity to align the risks and incentives in such a way to accomplish that. So the pay-for-performance idea is really structured on the notion of changing to some way the traditional way that utilities or the Energy Trust of Oregon have provided their incentive payments. Rather than assuming what the savings are going to be from a particular project and paying that incentive or that cash payment that Juliet talked about in what I call year zero, at the very beginning of the project. In fact, changing that so that the incentive is paid on an annual basis based on measured and verified savings at the meter. So the utility or the energy trust is only going to pay for energy savings that actually occur. And what this does is, first off, we think it changes the investment psychology on the part of the business owner, because now they actually have a real revenue stream that comes in on an annual basis. And we think that may provide more impetus for them to make the kinds of capital investments that we would like to see in buildings to get to some of these kinds of deeper savings. So I'll show you a graph in just a second. And I won't spend a lot of time on this particular slide, because I think the folks in the PUC really articulated this quite nicely. There's a number of really great energy trust programs and other utility programs in Oregon that pay sort of the rebate up front. You go in, you buy a more efficient dishwasher or refrigerator, and there's a rebate. Those make sense, and those should continue. We're not looking to throw out traditional programs. We're just thinking for this particular important market sector, this kind of mid to large size commercial and institutional sector, there may be a complementary approach that makes a lot of sense. Okay, sort of a busy graph here. Let me just walk you through this carefully if I can. On the x-axis here, the horizontal axis, this is just time. This is the expected duration of savings from doing an energy efficiency project within a building. In this case, it's just to 10 years. And then there's some magnitude of savings that we assume from that project on the y-axis there. And these are not real buildings. These are just prototypes or examples of how things might occur in any particular project. Well, the flat line, which is assumes, I think that's 100,000, if you could read the number on the left-hand side, let's say 100,000 kilowatt hours per year was assumed. That would be the amount of savings that the utility or the energy trust would pay an incentive on. And if it's a project that goes according to plan, those 100,000 kilowatt hours are going to show up at the meter every year over the lifetime of that measure, year one, year two, year three, year four, year five. And for a lot of projects, that's exactly what happens. It's particularly easy to see that happening when we do lighting retrofits, because lighting is a really predictable thing. It happens. Lights are sort of on or off. We use them kind of in the same way from year to year. But if we want to get deeper within these commercial buildings, we get into the thermal side of things. How we condition the buildings, how we control energy through our building automation systems, that introduces a lot more variability. And it's really possible to see the kinds of outcomes where the lines degrade there over time. And in this case, if the utility or the energy trust has paid that incentive in year zero, then they don't have any recourse in relationship to the uncertainty of those savings over time. Now, this is for some drama here. We've run that to zero. That's maybe a little over dramatic here, but I wanted to give you a sense about what that kind of future risk bubble might look like. Well, if we had the opportunity to incent that building owner to say, the better you operate this building over time, and the better you use the technology we deployed in the building, the more significant that incentive payment is going to be on an annualized basis, then we think from the industry perspective that it's possible to get that top line. We might see a little variability over time, but if we bring the technology and the behavior together and we put the right incentive structure in place, then we can get this extra bundle of savings that we otherwise aren't going to get, and we can do it with less risk in association with using the utility dollars to pay for that incentive. Hopefully that wasn't too busy of a graph. I'd be happy to go back to it during question period. We think from the industry side that there's some real opportunities to present this to building owners and asset managers of this particular class of buildings and get them more excited about doing these kinds of retrofits within their buildings. We think it changes the investment psychology to put an incentive on the table that's based on an annualized revenue stream as opposed to just simple operational cost reductions. And we've been having some conversations with building owners that make us believe that that's true. And I'll let Tom talk a little bit more about that because he's the guy that's out there every day talking to building owners about it. This particular slide is almost impossible for me to read these days with that size font, so I did blow it up for members of the committee, and I won't go through each cell way too much, other than to say we tried to evaluate this concept in relationship to thinking about this approach and some critical factors. What does it do in relationship to risk, the quantification of the energy savings, the persistence of those savings, the cost, and other kinds of market factors to give you an idea about how this would fare in relationship to the traditional program approach. And we think as we went through that it looks favorable to us in relationship to thinking about a real significant market opportunity. So I'll leave it at that other than to say, as Jason and Juliet mentioned, we have been having some conversations in Washington State about this concept, and Seattle City Light, the municipal utility in the city of Seattle, is committed to a pilot program. As you can see, the RFPs are due in a couple of weeks. The market response has been quite robust, and Tom knows a little bit about that because his compatriots in the Seattle office there have been very much involved in this as well. So thank you for your time, and I'll let Tom also continue.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a quick
question? Yeah, Representative Dembo.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So this is kind of a bonehead question. Please forgive me. This is day one. But what would be some examples of measure by measure? You know, I mean, there's the contrast between looking at things measure by measure as opposed to the total comprehensive building. So what would be some of those measures that would be examples?
Yeah, Chair Bailey, Representative Dembo. It's not a bonehead question at all. It's a great question. Individual measures, and particularly in this particular class of buildings, commercial and institutional buildings, it's been very easy to go in and do simply replace lighting fixture by fixture. And we take out an old inefficient fixture that may have T12 fluorescent lamps, and there's new generation of lighting technologies, and we can put in different fixtures that produce the exact same amount of light and just do it with fewer watts. So we can do that one measure, and many building owners have done a lot of sort of individual light replacement. A more comprehensive thing is trying to think about the building as a system and all the interactive effects in terms of what people really want inside their buildings, which is they want all of the things that the energy system provides. They want comfort conditions, they want whatever, they want their computers and lights and all the things that we do inside our buildings to work. When we think about all the energy using systems together as a system, it presents many more significant technology opportunities to manage energy use. That would be a much more whole building approach as opposed to individual measure.
I hope
I got that right.
Yeah, absolutely. If I might hazard perhaps a layperson's interpretation, you can tell me if I've got it wrong. It's like if I'm going to the store and I've got $10 to spend on groceries and I want to buy 10 items and I've got about an average of $1 to spend per item, and in my basket I want to make sure I've got items to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and I find that jam is $1.50, but peanut butter is 50 cents. And under a measure-by-measure basis, I wouldn't be able to buy my jelly to make my peanut butter and jelly sandwich. If I save 50 cents on my peanut butter, I can spend a little bit more on my jelly and make sure I'm able to make my sandwich and stay within my budget. Is that about right?
Yeah, may you please direct all future questions to Chair Bailey, who does a much better job than I do at explaining this.
And, sorry, one more thing. In terms of context, Tom, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding right. As you're going out and making these sales and talking about the kind of system that Mr. Price discussed, the sales that you're making are, at least in part, to building owners, private building owners, who are evaluating this on a bottom-line financial basis, exclusive of any environmental benefits or other ancillary benefits that are unmeasured.
That's correct.
Bottom-line business case basis, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It's looked at as a return on investment for those owners of the facilities in any way that they would capitalize most other improvements within their facility infrastructure. Although there are slight obvious advantages in a tight market, as an example, for commercial property owners to have sustainable features within their facility, I've never seen that win out the day in having discussions with our clients. It's really about that return on investment analysis that they do. And as Stan has indicated, this pay for performance program allows us to blend the peanut butter, the jelly, the bread, and the milk, so to speak, if you like milk with your peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and look at a more holistic meal, as it were. And also to ensure that you're buying those parts and pieces in a way that are not harmful to your body, harmful to the overall operation of the facility, and are sustainable over the long term, or have that long term savings potential that Stan has described in that graphical that he showed.
Representative Witt, did you have a comment before? You still have more to present, correct?
Well, the only thing I was going to say was just give a little more context for our company and who I am and what I do and is part of the industry. So McKinstry, we're a design, build, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, data services company with this element of energy services. I happen to lead the energy services part of the business for Oregon. So our territory stretches from Southwest Washington down to Northern California. McKinstry, holistically in Oregon, based out of Portland, we're doing a little bit more than $125 million worth of work, and we have 350 employees, a combination of both white collar and blue collar in a truly integrated sales force. I offer that context just to let you know the expertise on this level is not only my 20 years of experience, it's the deep bench and resources that we have at our disposal when we look at these types of projects to bring efficiency improvements in the built environment, in the existing environment. The other thing that I was going to mention, and Stan teed this up on the SCL pilot, during the conceptualization of that pilot, one utility executive had commented, why do end users need a new program? And I think that's part of the question that we've brought up here already. And our answer is really simple, is that the owners in the private sector need new tools and revised programs engineered to address the real efficiency opportunity in their buildings. And I would add to it, it's just not just the commercial sector that we're speaking to in this. It's also the institutional campus built environment where you're looking again at that your example, Representative Bailey, the holistic view of how to get that peanut butter and bread and a full meal into it. These are clients that are responding to an RFP that the Seattle City Light has put out. McKinstry has 7 clients that have stepped up to the plate in response to this pilot program and asked us to, on their behalf, represent them to come forward, offer that they would provide their facilities as part of this pilot program. They're clients with campus infrastructure, data center space, downtown office space, multi-tenant buildings. Their clients are typically the most difficult to motivate, honestly, towards energy efficiency because they have a very short window on their return on investment. They want to see a simple payback normally in the low, 1 to 2 year range. And that doesn't allow us to go deep with energy retrofits. That's the typical lighting project, small motor project, that sort of thing, the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. These are clients that are also now suddenly interested in helping to catalyze deeper energy retrofits. They're thinking about capital and operational savings. And the operational piece, I think both Juliet and Jason made mention of this. The operational savings, those things that are about control systems that can be changed over time. Once you get your incentive through the deemed savings program, there's really no continued incentive to make sure that that set point on that thermostat remains at the lower level beyond just the basic savings. So, again, we feel strongly that that there's a market for this. We feel that the SCL program is a good program as a starting point, and we would love to see the same thing come to fruition here in Oregon. We feel that we owe it to our customers and to the market in general that that we represent that.
Thank you both. Representative Woods, did I cut you off earlier? Sorry.
I was just wondering, what's your minimum square footage that you look for in a building? Does it make a difference if it's a high rise? I mean, it's sort of a complicated question. Or if it's like plan, one floor, spread out. And have you estimated how many buildings in Oregon and what cities they're in that you could potentially expand this to?
Representative Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, you're right. That is a complicated question to answer. And we first look, speaking about how we currently do business, we first look at a vertical market that would be receptive to a return on investment that may go out a little bit longer. So historically speaking, through energy savings performance contracting, we're looking at institutional facilities. Those clients, those owners that hold on to their assets for long periods of time because they need to remain fluid in the ability to offer that property into the market if they need to. We believe there's a huge opportunity, again, as I said, in the commercial sector, and large commercial sector, as well as in the campus environment on the institutional level. That a threshold, a rule of thumb, 100,000, 200,000, somewhere in that neighborhood, depending on systems. Market analysis, we haven't done enough research to know specifics on that from my team's vantage point. I think Stan might have some more info just on the broader market potential.
You can watch Tom and I argue over the square footage threshold now. I think it's certainly possible to think about buildings even at the 50,000 square foot as being as potential opportunities. Some of that will depend upon what the end use occupancy is. That might be on the low end for sort of an office space, but if you're thinking about other occupancies, I could even see potentially grocery stores being potential candidates for this. So I think mid-sized commercial, depending upon the end-use occupancy, we might be able to push that threshold down, certainly as low as, say, 50,000 square feet.
Representative Reed?
I'm not sure how long you want to carry this on, but
this is our last panel, so.
Okay. Oh, great. Okay.
Have at it.
This is all right. This is really interesting, and I'm trying to get at how you're in the business of providing energy efficiency solutions, so you probably look at the issue one way, and how much business can we do over the next 20 years. If I look at it as if we do nothing as a state, and we just carry on as we are, we're going to be maybe increasing our amount of generation over time, a certain amount. If we do something like this, how much can we honestly expect to avoid in additional? So if I am PGE or PPL or other utilities, are we really saving anything over time? Are we really reducing our carbon footprint? On and on.
And I may interrupt And you were welcome to comment on the question as well. I think some of that is addressed in the sixth power plan that I believe that the PUC and folks will discuss it a week from today. So we'll
be able to wait until the next
you can go through a little bit of that as well. But if you've got any color commentary on that as well, I'd be happy to hear.
It's Representative Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon. It's a great question, and certainly there are others, Chair Bailey, and folks from the Public Utility Commission and from the Power Planning Council will be able to give you really good information about that. I would maybe, if I could twist that answer a little bit in relationship to thinking about the value proposition, which is rightfully thinking about the utility system and the value proposition to the utility system of acquiring inexpensive resources like energy efficiency, and the value of doing that as opposed to pursuing other alternatives which might be a higher cost. The other side of this is thinking about the value to the actual customer themselves. So we are sort of installing energy efficiency in their buildings, but way beyond just energy efficiency, obvious cost reduction. They use less energy. It's going to cost them less for to run their operations, whether you're heating your home or running your business or deploying your industrial process. But there's a lot of productivity opportunities. Putting in new technology and infrastructure will make Oregon's businesses more competitive and industrial processes more competitive to compete globally because we'll help them reduce their operational costs and improve productivity. So there is a customer side bonus to this outside the value proposition to the utility system. This is going out and improving core infrastructure in our built environment and in our industrial processes. And I think that's a really important value proposition to keep in mind when evaluating this.
We'll go down here, and then we'll come back. Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll kind of go in more lines, probably on your industrial, because I actually have a little bit of experience in this world. So, matter of fact, I'll be at the facilities management show here in March, so in Baltimore. But one of the problems that I see, you go in and do upgrades, or even with some of the older buildings, it's more the maintenance and the upkeep. And one of the things when you're dealing with buildings versus, say, a paper mill can realize it because they need to get more paper out the door, so they want to speed up the machine, make it more efficient. When you're dealing with a building, large chiller, things like that, it's tough to change the mindset of somebody because they can't afford to go buy a laser alignment. Well, even your company, you don't put a laser alignment tool in each one of your rigs. You don't have vibration equipment. You don't have balancing equipment in your vehicles. So even with your installations, are you doing a full service to really hit the optimum efficiency, and how do we get the mentality changed in the facilities management area for this? So we're sitting here talking about it, and it's all good and dandy, but I don't see us really achieving that optimum space until we can get the installers doing it right. And I don't see us going beyond lighting and potentially insulation, things like that, to ever really change this industry. And I'm wondering if we're kind of wasting our time here, because I couldn't see the savings of doing any more than lighting and insulation for these plants. If you think I'm wrong, I would like to hear your take on it, because you're talking to the customers day in and day out. I'm talking to the service guys on my side.
Sure. Well, Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, you're singing my song there when you're saying those things. Those are the challenges that we face often with our clients. And one of the things that's interesting and intriguing about a program like this, Pay for Performance, is it's a more solid connector. It's a more solid incentive to those teams in integrating properly and providing those tools that you mentioned, that training that goes along with properly maintaining facilities, because there's a revenue stream attached to it. Historically speaking, through the deemed savings program, once you get the incentive, once you're, you know, anointed that you're now, you know, efficient, there's beyond the initial, check to see that the equipment is installed. You know, generally speaking, there's not a persistence program built into that, and I think you're right in saying that there's many challenges that we face, but I would also say that this is a step in the right direction. towards answering that question, that problem that you bring up. Representative Deborah?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the things that attracts me to efficiency investments as opposed to generation for a state like Oregon is that efficiency projects involve a lot of workforce, right, local workforce. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, how that figures into, you know, the overall calculation of the, you know, what this adds to the economic vitality of the region of the state.
You know, I can speak to it, you know, just from my perspective as you know, as operating a business unit. You know, it's pretty organic. You know, I'm, you know, most folks on the committee, I'm sure understand, you know, the budgeting process that we go through to hire people, and how this opportunity would create that that additional skill set requirement for us. I can't speak to how that relates holistically until we answer the question that Representative Witsit brought up about market opportunity. You know, and I think that's what we're going through right now. And one of the exciting things, again, for us and how we evaluate our business and seeing a pilot program like this start to come to fruition is now we're thinking about how we invest as a corporation to build the team to get to that. So I'm sorry I'm not answering your question directly, but it's something that we're thinking about.
And if Representative, I'm sorry, if I could just add on quickly that I think your instincts are a good one in relationship to thinking about these kinds of jobs really start to look like construction jobs. So when sort of McKinstry's sort of done with the sort of design process, at the end this becomes about electricians and sheet metal workers and plumbers and pipe fitters are really the people that are going in and doing these sorts of improvements within buildings. So it's the skilled trades that really get the significant bump in relationship to thinking about the throughput side of actually making the project happen within the building.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a hard time accepting the premise that in an owner-occupied environment, once they go through a comprehensive energy efficiency process and so forth, getting themselves as lean and efficient as possible, that they don't then monitor or follow up to ensure that what they invest in or what they put into their plant or into their system doesn't operate at peak efficiency, because there's a direct economic benefit to them. And I'll tell you what I'm talking about in a personal example is several years ago our school district in Hood River set out to say, you know, we want to invest, do what we can do. We had some bond money we could use to go ahead and do a district-wide energy evaluation. First of all, we hired an ESCO, McKinstry, by the way, come in. They did a comprehensive evaluation where we could get the most bang for the buck, whether it's insulation, windows, boilers, all of the above. You all came back with a proposal, RFP, that said if you will do X, Y, Z, and blah, 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 a long list, we will guarantee you this percentage or this dollar amount, a specific dollar amount of savings in your district-wide energy uses on a monthly or an annual basis. And we said, okay, deal, let's do it. So we came in, did it. You know, we now have the ability to monitor the, you know, the energy usage in every school building, basically. And this was before cool schools, by the way, because we're a cool school district.
You guys are leaders.
we can monitor what's going on in every building at a given time. If something goes wrong, Our facilities manager will know that.
Yeah.
Every janitor, every building official there knows how those, you know, things are to be set, so forth. They watch it. As a school board member, we're watching the bottom line now to ensure that that system gives us the payback that we've invested in that. So, again, it's hard for me to imagine that once people jump through all these hoops, do all this, get this in place, that they just kind of walk away and say, well, that's it, we're done. So can you give me specifics where you're seeing this happening? In owner-occupied properties where there's a real, you can say, you know, you guys are leaving money on the table because you're not ensuring that the system is performing up to its potential.
Sadly, we can. Your story is a great one, and hooray. I mean, that is exactly the outcome we want. In fact, we want folks to to be motivated and to understand how to use these systems and think about that energy use over time and continue to try to optimize the performance of systems post-installation. So what you described is an incredibly great success story, but unfortunately, oftentimes more the exception than the rule. A couple of data points in that regard. There's been a lot of follow-up work to look at the energy efficiency performance of LEED-rated buildings nationally. LEED is the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. So without getting into the merits of the LEED building, those actually should be newly constructed buildings that should be the cream of the crop. But when we looked post-installation at some of the energy performance of those buildings, frankly, it was a scatter plot. And so what you had were people who came into buildings that had the technology installed. They just weren't driving the boat correctly. So there's a lot of good data that shows that, well, a lot of data, not good data, unfortunately, a lot of data that shows that, unfortunately, paying attention after the technology is deployed isn't certainly always the case. There are a number of municipalities now across the United States that are involved in what's called energy performance disclosure, where commercial buildings larger than 50,000 square feet are actually look at their energy use and disclosing it. New York City is one of them, the City of Seattle, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and so forth. That data is also corroborating the fact that we are not getting the actual performance out of the buildings requisite to the potential that's there. So there's, unfortunately, a lot of data.
Okay. Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your presentation. Thanks so much for the time. Committee, thanks for indulging the dive right in. We're going to look forward to lots more discussions, and if you have any additional LCs, make sure to get them to me. Anything else? Are we done? Close the informational meeting, and committee is adjourned.
So what's the ask of these guys? Was there an ask, or just simply
well, sort of.